Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking about some people who have joined the cast and crew of Discovery in more ways than one.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously the big news is Jason Isaacs. And you know, we missed out on that because we had our week off last week.
That's true.
But we can tackle that again in a little bit. But let's start with some director news, shall we?
Yeah. Well, yes, this is a very interesting tidbit.
Yeah, okay. So, first off, Adam Kane seems to be directing the second episode of the show. Now, it's a little confusing. It looks like the pilot is 2 hours, so you could count those as episodes 1 and 2, and then this would be episode 3. But on the picture of the slate, which was posted online, it mm-hmm. says episode 102. So, yeah. You know, I don't know. But like, if you look at IMDb, which is interesting, although not necessarily 100% accurate, they show David Semel is directing episodes 1 and 2, being the right. pilot, and then Kane directing episode 3. Kane is a director who has worked on a number of television shows, which are rather high profile, including things like Pushing Daisies, Kings, Mercy, which is a Bergen Harbert show, mm-hmm. Haven, The Mentalist, Heroes. He did five episodes
again.
Of Heroes. Yeah. Falling Skies, Sleepy Hollow, 24, Live Another Day. He did an episode of Hannibal. He did an episode of Daredevil and Minority Report, Supergirl, and he's got a couple of episodes of American Gods, which he directed.
I find it interesting, but like, did you direct an episode of Hannibal? You're pretty much in the mix, it seems like. You
know, yeah, like, I think so. Yeah.
You're under consideration.
Yeah. Now, he's an executive producer on 5 episodes of American Gods, apparently, and he was also a producer on Mercy and Pushing Daisies and some other things. So he was the co-executive producer for 26 episodes on Being Human, which seems like a show which he was like the lead director on there.
That was an interesting show. I watched the first like 2 or 3. Did he direct the original British? No, he directed the American adaptation, right?
Yeah, that was on Sci-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah, the one that has Sam Witwer in it.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, which was I didn't stay with the show all the way through, but it was a good show.
Yeah.
The bulk of it that I did watch, I enjoyed.
Interesting. You know, I'll have to check that out for sure. I mean, one of the interesting things about his career early on is that he started off as a cinematographer. He actually shot the pilot for Heroes, which is kind of interesting. Especially since the pilot was directed by David Semel himself, you know. So there's that kind of connection there, and he shot a number of movies. You know, that was pretty much his thing back in the 90s and the early aughts. Most noteworthy, he was the cinematographer on the cult classic, The Boondock Saints.
I still haven't seen that. I've heard so many people rave about it, and it comes up on Amazon Prime every so often, and it's always on my queue, and then I never get to it. You know, it's one of those ones where I'm almost afraid to watch it now because its reputation is so outsized that I'm like, you know those sorts of things where you're almost terrified to try it because you're like, oh man, if I don't like this, I'm going to disappoint like everybody in the world.
Yeah, it's one of those things which I've always had trouble wrapping my head around because, like, it didn't even get a theatrical release. It was direct-to-video, but, you know, people were, you know, talking about it in the same vein as, like, Tarantino movies and everything. And then, like, the director was really hot, and then he basically didn't do anything after that. It was mm-hmm. It's a strange movie. But I definitely do have to check it out because so many people have talked about it for such a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Kane is directing the episode right after the pilot, whatever that may be. You know, he's directing the episode right after the pilot. And, you know, you would think that that would imply that he would be like the producing director or the lead director, which we thought Vincenzo Natali was, or which Vincenzo Natali was, you know, I mean, for
right.
at least the Fuller years, if you want to call it that. but, you know, it's starting to look like he's not involved in the show anymore.
No, not terribly too much, no.
I mean, for one thing, he's no longer listed on IMDb as a director. Not that that necessarily means anything, because IMDb can be edited by anyone and it can mean, you know, basically anything that anyone wants it to mean.
Right.
But he's still listed as a producer of the pilot, which, again, could just be someone assuming something or whatever.
I think the producer list on that pilot, if we go by what we've seen on IMDb and other sources up to this point, it's going to have like 400 producers on it. They're going to need like a whole theme just for the producers.
Yeah, and that's typical TV stuff. And also, you know, sort of like gets into that problem of like what is a producer, you know? I mean, the title could mean anything from, you know, the auteur of the show to somebody who bought the rights before he died, but now he's dead. And,
right.
You know, I mean, literally. So, like, Jerry Weintraub is a producer on Westworld, you know? He's dead. So, you know.
Jerry Weintraub's estate
yeah.
is a producer on Westworld.
Yeah, so take any producer credit as you will. Who knows exactly what it means. But one interesting thing, which is not on the IMDb, which, you know, sort of throws in the Adam Kane producing director theory into doubt, is that there is someone who is a producer director for this show, and his name is Olatunde Osunsanmi. Now, yeah. Osunsanmi, he put on his Twitter bio that he is the producer director of Star Trek Discovery. So that's pretty definitive right there.
You know, the only way he's going to walk that back is to say he was hacked. And I don't think that's going to happen.
No. And, you know, I mean, again, you could be a producer and a director and not be the, you know, lead director or whatever, you know, and it's all sort of a nebulous thing to begin with, you know. But it would seem to indicate that he is the lead director on the show now, you know. At least that's how I take it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird. There's so much. When we were talking about this on the other side of the stage, my first reaction was that the behind the scenes stories, and we've beaten this drum for a while, but it just seems like there's been a complete shift in creative direction.
Yeah.
Maybe not like a gutting, because, you know, Berg and Harberts are, you know, of the Fuller school, but it really seems like CBS saw what was coming and said, this is not quite what we want. Thanks for your time. Because it seems like they've been cleaning house ever since.
It could be that. It could be that, you know, when Berg and Harberts took over, they were like, we want to bring in our people, you know? Mm. I mean, even though a lot of them would be the same people, you know, there's probably, you know, I mean, you see this whenever there's like a shift in management, right? I mean, it's like some people, you know, stay, some people go.
Although maybe it's something seriously just as simple as they said to Fuller, you know, thanks for this, we're going to take it from here. And then when the schedule shifted, maybe it's as simple as Natali was just like, I can't do it, guys, sorry, I already committed to something thinking I was going to do this 4 months ago.
Yeah, it could be that, or it could also be, you know, people loyal to Fuller, you know, because I mean, as much as everyone is saying like this is just a case of scheduling, that's the only reason why they parted ways, you know, there was that whole thing where like what's his name? Steve Weintraub from Collider,
yeah.
The guy who runs Collider, he tweeted how he was like talking to Fuller and he's like, oh, Fuller just told me, you know, what CBS did to him. It makes me sick how they're treating him, you know, without getting into any details at all.
Right.
You know, it definitely sounds like something off the record, you know, did happen.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like they didn't validate his parking one day, you know.
Yeah. So who knows? But there has definitely been, a lot of people coming and going, and it looks like Natalie's one of them. It also looks like Craig Sweeney, who just came on, you know, fairly late, is not there anymore because, again, his Twitter bio, you know, used to list, you know, writer-producer of Star Trek Discovery, and now it doesn't. So
I mean, I don't know enough about the intricacies of how it works in terms of, you know, giving credit to somebody as a writer-producer. Like, is it possible that he worked on it and, like, it's almost like a who wrote the script for Rogue One sort of thing? Where it's like, you got paid, but you didn't do enough with what the final material is or something
to
like
actually
that.
Get like a screen credit or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that could be, you know, I mean, like reading that book, the 50-year mission book, it really sort of gives you insight into, like, you know, how these things work. And it really is just like any other business, you know, where people are contracted for X amount of time. And then after their contract's up, sometimes they're renewed, sometimes they leave. It's not like some sort of like magical thing where, you know,
right.
I mean, it really is just like a job in a lot of ways, you know, it's just a really cool job. So, you know, yeah. I mean, who knows? Maybe they brought Sweeney on and they're like, look, you know, we need you for a week or whatever. Not a week, but, you know, a month or whatever. And then we'll see how it goes. And then at the end, you know, maybe he was like, I don't want to be there. Who knows? Who knows?
Well, I mean, the thing is, looking at Os Insomni's resume, he's really sci-fi focused, in a lot of ways. Because there's The Fourth Kind, The Last Ship, Extant, Sleepy Hollow, Minority Report, Under the Dome. I mean, you know, that's really... Oh, and then there's Falling Skies. He worked on that.
Yeah, and that's the big one. Because, okay, I mean, probably what he's best known for is writing and directing The Fourth Kind, which was a movie that came out in 2009, I believe. It's a rather controversial movie, from what I understand.
Did that say it was based on a true story or something like that?
It said it was based on a true story, and there was some... You know, they talk about how, I guess, there were some, like, interviews which were recorded, you know, and there was something where, like, the movie claimed to be using, you know, the real interviews, but in fact, some of them were staged, you know, that kind of thing. So there was some shady territory in there, I guess.
Nobody complained about Blair Witch Project.
No, but this was based on something that did happen like fairly recently. Oh, okay. With like people still being around, and I guess like the families and stuff were rather upset at how they felt like
I didn't realize this was something where those sorts of toes have been stepped on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
now I really gotta see it.
Yeah Well, you know, we're talking about watching it for next week, so
I think we should.
Yeah, if anyone's looking for it, right now it's $5 on iTunes, so there you go. You can own it, or you can get it for like $1 less on, you know.
Hope you love it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll see. But, you know, he's directed a couple of other things. You know, he got his start, you know, from what I understand, working with Joe Carnahan, and he even wrote Carnahan's sequel, I guess Carnahan produced it, to Smoke and Aces 2, which was a direct-to-video sequel.
Wait, not Smoke and Aces 2, yes. But a sequel to Smoke and Aces 2?
No, sorry, you're right. The sequel to Smoking Aces, which is known as Smoke and Aces 2, yes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I've seen that. I own that. I've got it right on the shelf, right over there. And it's not bad. I liked it.
I really liked Smoke and Aces. Would I like Smoke and Aces too?
Yeah, I mean, imagine like a direct-to-video version of Smoke and Aces.
I don't know, direct-to-video. I will always carry the scar of Return of Jafar.
Yeah, then there was Aladdin and the King of Thieves that redeemed it.
I'm pretty sure that after Return of Jafar, I said, "Nah, I'm not doing this again."
Well, but they got Robin Williams back for Aladdin and the King of Thieves.
Okay.
Aladdin and the King of Thieves.
Are you telling
me
I have to go and see Aladdin and the King of Thieves now?
It's a good movie. I'm not saying, like, you gotta go see Aladdin and the King of Thieves. You know, it's a masterpiece. It's the, you know, Empire Strikes Back of the Aladdin franchise
the
or something.
The Citizen Kane of direct-to-video releases.
It's not that, but it's you know, a perfectly decent movie, you know?
All right, maybe I'll watch it with the kids.
Yeah, it's fun. It's funny.
All right.
But, you know, with Ossin Sanmi, he directed a few movies. You know, Fourth Kind was the biggest one. The other ones were rather low-budget affairs. And then he kind of fell into the niche of directing television, which is where he seems to have, you know, excelled. I mean, I know that you were listing off some of his directorial efforts, including, like, Minority Report, Sleepy Hollow, Bates Motel, Gotham. He directed last week's episode of Colony, if anyone watched that. So there you go. Legends of Tomorrow. But the most interesting one, for sure, is Falling Skies. And the reason why that's interesting is because of how he got the job. He, this is according to Wikipedia, so, you know, hey, could be completely wrong. But he was contracted to direct one episode during season four, and he did. And apparently it went really well, because when another opening popped up at the end of season four due to a scheduling conflict, the cast and crew of the show were like, hey, you know, get Olatunde. You know, we really liked working with him and everything. So based on the recommendation of his peers, he got, you know, a second episode on Falling Skies. And apparently that went really well too, because for the fifth and final season of the show, the director in residence, the producing director, whatever you want to call it, of Falling Skies decided to leave, which meant there was an opening. And based on, you know, the recommendations of the cast and crew, Ossin Sanmi got the job directing the season as producer, as like co-executive producer, director of Falling Skies. And he directed four episodes that season, including the season premiere and the series finale. So that, to me, is really interesting, because, I mean, you hear about this, I mean, all the time. You know, I mean, there's, you know, genius directors who are not exactly the easiest to work with and everything like that. And, you know, there's also, you know, people who create a very inviting atmosphere on a set. You know, people who, you know, are good co-workers and good managers and stuff like that, you know, just like any other job.
Well, yeah, and there are also bosses that are difficult to work with if you're not part of their family, as it were. Like the cast and crew may have felt protected by him when somebody tried to interfere. He might be one of those people that on one side, you know, it's like, hey, what's up, man? But like to everybody that works with him that he looks out for, they're like, no, we love this guy. He's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, just the fact that, you know, the crew was like, hey, you know, we want this guy back. We like this guy. We want him back. I mean, that's that really does say something, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, it was for a sci-fi television show, again, you know, more sci-fi, like even The Fourth Kind, which is like a horror movie kind of at its heart. It's still a sci-fi movie. And Falling Skies is a pretty high-profile, you know, sci-fi movie with a lot of people who are working on you know, Discovery, even, who are working on the show, including Doug Jones, you know, who is one of the alien guys, I believe, on Falling Skies.
You know, you really don't have to say that.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
You can just say that he was on the show, and everybody's sort of gone like, oh, he must have been one of the alien guys.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. But yeah, I mean, have you seen Falling Skies at all or not?
I haven't. I haven't watched one moment of it, but I'm intrigued. I'm very intrigued.
I'm intrigued too. You know, and I always wanted to see it, and I when I found out about, you know, Ossin Sanmi, I decided to put on the season 5 premiere because it's on Amazon Prime for anyone who wants to watch it. And, it's pretty cool. Visually, it's very striking. You know, it has that sort of, like, post-apocalyptic future thing going on. It was created by Robert Rodat, who is probably best known as the writer of Saving Private Ryan. And he also wrote The Patriots, which, hey, maybe we'll talk about in a few minutes.
I think there's a tie there.
And he, you know, the people like behind the scenes were a lot of the BSG people, like David Icke, Thompson and Weddle from, you know, DS9, Mark Verheiden, you know, and all those guys. And also noteworthy, one of the directors during the season that Osun Sanmi ran the directing for was Jonathan Frakes. The plot.
Interesting.
The plot thickens.
There's a tie for you.
Yeah. So very exciting, you know, to see at least, you know, some formal stuff coming into the play, and you know, it'll be interesting to take a look at everyone's work and see what we can expect from this new series.
For sure.
Okay, but of course, the thing that everybody wants to talk about, right?
Oh yeah,
is the fact that there's a new captain, a new Star Trek captain.
Yes,
and that
keeping in mind that the captain's not the main character.
Yeah, and there's there's multiple captains, you know, on multiple ships on this show. But
yes,
the new captain of the Discovery is Jason Isaacs.
Dun dun dun!
Yeah,
a guy with a heck of a CV through time.
Yeah,
I mean, good grief.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, may not know the name, but when you see the face, you'll be like, oh, yeah, it's that guy, you know?
Harry Potter. He's Lucius Malfoy.
There you
Boom.
Go.
Boom. At least three quarters of the audience just said, oh, that guy.
Yeah, that's probably what he's best known for.
Oh, hands down.
And, I mean, I've seen all of those movies, and I definitely remember him from those movies, but I guess I'm not super familiar with his work on them. I know, like, I asked, you know, people when the news broke, I'm like, which one should I watch? And everyone's like, Chamber of Secrets. He goes crazy
one.
He's a crazy bad guy in that one.
Chamber of Secrets for him.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had my initial reaction to just hearing Chamber of Secrets and saying, no.
I did enjoy Chamber of Secrets because it had the little cute elf guy, you know?
Dobby. Played by Warwick Davis.
And I had the Dobby poster hanging up at work for years because it was cute, you know? But he's done a lot of other things. You know, he was in a lot of the old Paul W.S. Anderson movies like Shopping, you know, and Event Horizon and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
Event Horizon.
Soldier.
Yeah.
He was in The Patriot, which was written by Rodat, and he played the bad guy in that, Colonel William Tavington.
Yes. Right?
And I think that's what I think of him most, you know, more than anything, that's what I think of him from, you know.
I try not to think of the movie The Patriot.
Well, I'm glad. Too much, so. You know what? I'm glad you said that because, you know,
Don't you do it. Don't you dare.
What?
Don't you dare suggest we watch it for the show. Please
No. I wasn't going to suggest that because, you know, I've had this conversation with many people where people are like, oh man, The Patriot is such a good movie.
It's not a good movie.
It's really not a good movie.
It's terrible, to borrow a phrase from Charles Barkley.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It's as straightforward as you can get, but it takes forever to get where it's going.
Yes, it does. But you know how he's really captured my heart.
I'm going to guess, but you go ahead and say it.
Voice of the Inquisitor on Star Wars Rebels.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Man.
And, you know, he was like the big bad guy in season one.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was cool. He had those lines going down his face.
Yeah. No, I loved the I think they've since retconned it backward and said that he was the Grand Inquisitor because there are other Inquisitors that we have encountered since. So he was the Grand Inquisitor, but he was just known as the Inquisitor.
Yeah.
Back before he got all famous and whatnot. So
And then, yeah, I mean, it's some of the other stuff that he's done is pretty cool. Like, he does a lot of voice work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He does a lot of the direct-to-video DC movies, and he's been the voice of Sinestro, Lex mm-hmm. Luthor, and Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, in Under the Red Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a very good movie.
Now, you mean Ra's al Ghul, though.
Right. If you want to pronounce it like Christopher Nolan does, but if you want to pronounce it the correct way, as established, I think prior to the animated series, but on the animated series, it's Ra's al Ghul.
I don't know.
Okay, all right.
Nolan overwrites everything for me, pretty much.
No, so. See, here's the thing. Like, as good as Nolan is, as much as Nolan, you know, may have made the best Batman movie and everything like that, the definitive Batman, the baseline for Batman, the Batman by which all other Batmen are judged, is the animated series.
You know, that's true. Actually, I was watching that recently, you know, just catching up on it because it's on Amazon Prime or whatever, just catching a couple episodes. And it is really, in all honesty, because like there's been this thing back and forth, like Batman does kill, Batman doesn't kill, Batman blah, 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 and like people going back and forth about what Batman will do. I think the thing that nestled the idea of Batman never killing was the animated series, because in one of the early episodes, he specifically says, "I don't kill."
Yeah.
And I think that is what shaped him from that point forward, because in Burton's movies, he definitely did kill.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I really think that the Batman in the animated series sort of represents what Batman is. I mean, I really do. You know, it's truer than true. I mean, it's what the comic books were. I don't know. I really do think that. But yeah, so that's why I say it's Rachel.
I'll tell you what TV series I won't watch season 2 for that Jason Isaacs is in.
What's that?
The OA.
Oh.
I did watch that Netflix show, The OA.
Oh, yeah?
We should talk about that. I want to make you watch it.
Okay, I'll watch it, you know? I've heard good things and I've heard bad things, so I'm curious who's correct.
The first episode grabs you. Jason Isaacs is great in it. He really is. He's like, even as my interest in it waned toward the end and I started getting less interested in it, when he was on screen, I was invested in what was going on because I thought he was interesting and I thought that his performance was compelling. So he actually was the saving grace of the back half of that series.
Okay. I'll have to check that out. He's also, it's noteworthy that he's in the new movie that just came out, the new horror movie, A Cure for Wellness, where I believe he plays the bad guy in that.
Well, when you find, you know, what you're good at, you got to go with it, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's his thing. Although I have to say that my absolute favorite Jason Isaacs movie and performance is in Armageddon.
Well, I mean, Armageddon is sort of a cut above everything else, isn't it?
I mean, it is. In Armageddon, he plays Roland Quincy, who's pretty much the smartest person on the planet.
Yeah.
So you might want to listen to him.
You know, Armageddon is one of those movies that I like, even though I don't. Like, it was so... Its baseline was so charming that as much as I wanted to despise it and hate it from beginning to finish, I wound up liking it, but not saying I liked it. You ever have those movies where like you don't want to admit you like it?
Sure.
Armageddon's definitely in that category.
Yeah, I've had movies like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had movies like that rather recently where you're like, God, I was really hoping this movie wouldn't be good. Because then, you know, and then you say you like it and people like look at you funny, like, really? Like, what's wrong with you? And especially when it's like not like an extremely good movie, because I can be like, Lost World is one of Spielberg's best, and people will be like, you're insane. And I'll be like,
I know somebody who did call you insane for saying that.
Yeah. And I'll be like, hey, no, let me defend this. You know, I can totally defend this movie, right? But like when you say something like, you know, I mean, to pull another Michael Bay movie, you know, off the top of my head, 13 Hours, it was pretty good. People are like, what's wrong with you, man? And I'm like,
I'd be standing there with you. Okay. I loved 13 Hours. I thought that was I thought that was an example of why Bay should not be making Transformers movies anymore, because when he actually indulges his better nature as a storyteller, his movies are actually compelling.
See, that's how
when he's telling something he cares about.
Like, that's how I felt about Pain and Gain, you know?
I haven't seen that, but the thing is, I liked 13 Hours, and now I want to go back and watch Pain and Gain, because I feel like anything that he has something personal to say during it is going to be worth watching.
I mean, I'm not the first person to describe it this way, but people, you know, do say, like, Pain and Gain is like if Michael Bay directed a Coen Brothers script. That's a pretty good analogy right there.
That's a great way to sell that movie.
It's pretty crazy. And Ed Harris is in it, which is great, you know.
He's awesome.
But yeah, no, Armageddon, I was watching it the other day because of this. You know, they have it on Netflix, so I just turned it on in the background. And I'm like, I mean, I've always loved Armageddon, but it's the type of thing where usually when I sit down to watch it, I'm like, this movie's really not that good. You know, I mean, it really does fall apart as soon as they, like, take off and go into space or whatever. Mm-hmm. But watching that opening sequence, I'm just like, this movie is absolutely freaking insane from frame one. Like,
it's charming. It's extremely charming.
It's very charming, but it's also, like, crazy, absolutely, yeah. 100% nuts. And the fact that that movie got made, not only got made, but was like the highest budgeted thing and like made the most money ever, you know, that kind of whatever it was, you know,
yeah.
Huge blockbuster. Like, that movie is insane.
If I recall correctly, because I haven't watched it in years, but didn't they make a point? And I think I remember reading an interview, I might be misremembering, but they specifically, like, somebody said, oh, well, you destroyed the Chrysler Building. Why was it the Chrysler Building? And he's like, because everybody blows up the Empire State Building. I wanted to do something different.
Yeah, there you go.
I was like, I was like, well, that's okay. I can respect that.
I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff in there, but, you know, it is super cheesy, you know, and one of my favorite parts has always been, like, when they introduce Jason Isaacs' character, and he's like, you might want to listen to him. He's pretty much the smartest man on the planet. I mean, just that line is just like, because everything, like, we need to get the best underwater oil drillers on the planet, you know?
Yeah.
They're the only ones who can save the world, you know, that kind of thing. It's hilarious, you know? They released that movie on Criterion, by the way, for those
Isn't
who don't
that the,
remember.
Didn't you cite that as the one where, like, Criterion had, like, a moment where they released it and you believe that in their room they were like, okay, we have to re-examine things, guys. We have to think about this.
I mean, I would believe that, you know, because it's like, wow. Although that disc is loaded with special... I mean, for one thing, it's the only place you can get the director's cut and the only place you ever will get the director's cut because
really?
Apparently the elements were lost in a fire or something like that.
Oh, that's tragic, man.
Yeah, I know. But, and it's, yeah, like, basically the big thing from the director's cut, it's only like a minute or two longer, but the big thing is there's a scene... where, you know, when they're all like, they need a couple days off. I'm not asking, I'm telling, make it happen, you know. And then they all go out for their R&R right before they're gonna go. They all get drunk right before they're gonna go up into space. While they're that sort of montage thing, there's a scene where Bruce Willis goes to visit his dad and basically say goodbye to his dad, and his dad's played by Lawrence Tierney. Yeah.
Come on!
It's a pretty great little moment.
I might have to go get the Criterion collection of this because I want to see that.
I imagine it's a collector's item at this point. Unfortunately,
probably.
They really botched it because it was back in the day when Criterion was under the impression that for some reason on 4x3 TVs, a 4x3 transfer would be better than a 16x9 transfer. So it's not even 16x9. But... it does have some amazing commentaries, like with NASA scientists and Ben Affleck, where he basically just mocks the movie for the whole time and talks about how absolutely ridiculous it is. And it's got John Schwartzman on there talking about how he broke into the industry by beating Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas in a game of Risk. I mean, it's a pretty epic, DVD, and definitely, if you can find it, check it out. So.
Cool, man. Cool. But all that to say that Jason Isaacs has a great resume, and he's going to, I mean, he's most likely going to bring however long he's in the series, we don't know how long he's going to survive. Let's not let's not count on him being in every episode, guys.
Hey, you never know, right? You never know. But, yep, he's the new captain, and hey, it's exciting. It's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, to repeat the thing we've been saying, as far as casting, they've really been taking care to get some great people.
Yep, yep. I don't know if you saw it, but apparently they all went out to dinner the other night, mm-hmm. and someone took a picture, a selfie, and it's the first picture of all of them together, and it's pretty great. It's pretty great to see the new crew, you know. All in one place. So
somebody on the internet needs to get out there and Photoshop in some old TOS uniforms onto that and let us know how that looks.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Turn Jones into an Andorian just for good measure.
Well, it's been fun talking about all the new people working on Discovery today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The ultimate fantasy was being called the ultimate fiasco, the ultimate fallacy, the ultimate F-up. And one girl on Sunday afternoon, she tells a story. They were walking to dinner, and she says, "Oh my God, you guys." They were talking some of these, you know, snarky names. She goes, no, you guys, listen. We've just survived the Con of Wrath." And they all, like, died laughing.
Warp 5.
At that time, you know, PTSD was not even a diagnosis. We had generations had different terms to describe issues with soldiers' heart, you know, combat fatigue, shell shock.
Melodic Treks.
I have a big love in my heart. You know, like, my top three episodes are Where No Man's Gone Before, Believe It or Not, The Alternative Factor, and The Lights of Zatar.
I just almost passed out.
Meta Treks.
For me, just as soon as Quark goes under the knife, kind of.
It is not essential Trek philosophy.
Something seriously goes wrong. Not for me, no.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Chris Steftenagle and Jeff Sutter. Thank you very much for helping us out, guys. If you want to be like Chris and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you, including early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll come right up. All right, well, that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to be taking a closer look at Olatunde Osunsanmi's major motion picture, The Fourth Kind.